News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Today is Monday, August 20th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:03 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. All this plus Simply Science by Sarah Chow, Dietetics Intuition by our health team, and a report from our correspondent in Australia, Alex Hamer, about asylum seekers in Australia. All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. It is now time for your campus and local headlines.
The UBC Alma Mater Society has announced that it plans to separate the management of its businesses from the organization's other student services. They have decided to create a new board of directors charged with overseeing all AMS businesses and their administration. By dissolving the Business and Facilities Committee and separating businesses and administration from student services and student government, the AMS hopes that this organizational change will address many of the issues in its current business model, such as complex internal relationships between committees and students. Eric Goff, restructuring coordinator with Reorganization of Business Operations Committee, told the UBC that this new structure, quote, makes it so there's a clear chain of responsibility, end quote. Former AMS Vice President of Finance, Ellen Tayar, stated that, quote, something like raising pizza prices is not something that the student government should worry about. The management is paid to do that and they're experts at that. Give them the responsibility and make them accountable for it, end quote. It has been suggested that since this is a back-end change, many students will not notice a difference in the services they are provided.
The provincial government will soon be stepping up its campaign to bar extra billing at a well-known private health clinic, but the owner of the clinic says he's keen for a fight. The BC Medical Services Commission gave the Cambie Surgery Centre 30 days to stop charging patients for services already offered in the public system. That deadline ran out on Friday. Ryan Jabs from the BC Ministry of Health said the province will be proceeding with an injunction to enforce the order shortly. Jabs couldn't elaborate. Dr. Brian Day, who runs the clinic, said he welcomes the injunction application because it will speed up his case and he's confident of victory. An injunction will give Day a court platform, Dr. Brian Day, a court platform to argue why he believes the service he provides is necessary. Dr. Day was part of a constitutional challenge launched in 2009, arguing the bar against allowing people to pay for private health care violates their democratic rights. He said, quote, how are you going to argue that a 79-year-old cancer sufferer with terminal cancer should be forced to wait 18 months? Because that's what they're going to have to argue, end quote. More than a dozen doctors and healthcare professionals protested outside Dr. Day's clinic on Monday, calling on the BC government to enforce the law and to stop the center from extra billing. The group's spokesman, Dr. Bob Willard, of Canadian Doctors for Medicare said the federal government should withhold health payments to BC until the law is enforced.
Executive positions at ICBC are being cut after a scathing government review released Thursday revealed a 315% increase among top brass earning over $200,000 within the past 5 years. The insurer is expected to cut approximately 135 management positions by 2014, and work has begun on implementing 24 government recommendations, many resolving around spending and providing better documentation. It has also implemented a company-wide hiring freeze, as well as a wage freeze for management. John Schubert, the CEO at the provincial auto insurer, will also step down on November 15th, but will stay on as a paid consultant through June of 2013. Schubert wrote in a company-wide memo that said, quote, "This is a mutual decision reached with the board. I'm committed to working towards an orderly transition to ensure that ICBC continues to fulfill its mandate," end quote. Finance Minister Kevin Falcon said the Crown Corporation increased management staffing and compensation during the recent recession years when other government arms were tightening their purse strings. In a statement, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation Jordan Bateman said the Crown Corporation's driving insurance, quote, "monopoly" simply isn't working. Bateman said, quote, "Government monopolies, like ICBC, need to be constantly monitored by politicians. Better yet, get taxpayers out of the insurance business altogether," end quote.
And those were your local, provincial, and national headlines on News 101. It is now time for your Simply Science by Sarah Chow.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. Yes. Imagine yourself wandering through a rainforest in Costa Rica. Relax. Nothing but a sea of green surrounding you. A gentle sound of a bird, the leaves rustling underneath your feet. And then...
Whoa, what was that? Well, you'd never guessed. That is the sound of a mouse singing. Yep, you heard right, a singing mouse. And that's the subject of our first bit of news. Because, believe it or not, scientists are actually studying these mice to understand human speech disorders. Sounds crazy, right? Well, here's the connection. These musical mice have a gene called FOXP2, and it's this gene that allows them to sing. And singing allows them to communicate with each other in the rainforest. In humans, the same gene allows us to speak. But researchers have found that mutations in this gene can lead to serious problems. For example, difficulty in understanding grammar, or not being able to make the precise mouth movements you need to speak clearly. So, researchers at the University of Texas are studying the FOXP2 gene in these singing mice to better understand how it works. More precisely, they want to know how the gene turns on, and when it turns on, what else happens? Do other genes in the body turn on? To figure that out, researchers recorded the mice singing, and then they played it back for the mice to hear. Researchers found that when a mouse hears a song from its own species, it activates brain cells containing the FOXP2 gene. So, what does that mean? Well, it means that this gene may play a role in converting the musical information into a chemical signal the body can react to. That's important because if scientists figure out how FOXP2 leads to human speech deficiencies, they may one day be able to prevent this disorder. Ever get grossed out seeing a used Band-Aid floating in a swimming pool? Ew, I sure do. Don't you just wish Band-Aids were strong enough to stick, even when wet? Well, studying how geckos stick to walls could hold the key to designing a synthetic waterproof bandage. Now, scientists already know geckos have teeny tiny hairs on the bottom of their toes to cling onto surfaces. It's just like the way Velcro works. That's why geckos can climb walls and ceilings so easily. But what about wet surfaces? How do they climb them? Researchers at the University of Akron, Ohio compared gecko toe grip when toes were dry and when they were wet on dry, misted, and wet glass surfaces. They then wrapped a mini harness around the gecko to gently pull on them to measure the strength of their grasp. They found when toes were wet, the geckos could barely hang on, regardless of whether the surface was dry or wet. This is because these reptiles have super hydrophobic toes. Yes, it sounds like a superpower they have, but it actually just means their toes repel water. So when wet, little balls of water accumulate underneath their toes, just like water beads on a waterproof jacket. This prevents them from creating a strong contact with the surface. However, when their toes were dry, geckos were able to get a firmer grip on the glass surface. So, researchers concluded that geckos can walk on wet surfaces as long as their feet are dry. But understanding how geckos grip wet surfaces may one day make floating used band-aids in pools a thing of the past. And personally, that day can't come any sooner. Now, my last piece of news is dedicated to those of you who still don't believe in climate change. It's because of climate change the Rocky Mountain ground squirrels are in trouble. Researchers at the University of Alberta followed these squirrels for 20 years and found that the late spring snowfalls have delayed them from coming out of hibernation by 10 days. Doesn't seem like a lot of time, does it? But it's a big deal for them. Ground squirrels only have 3 to 4 months to give birth, nurse their young, then eat enough food so they can survive the upcoming winter, which usually lasts for 8 to 9 months. That's not a lot of time. No wonder their population is barely keeping up. The study was published in the journal Nature. So the moral of the story? Don't try telling a ground squirrel there's no such thing as climate change. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for that Simply Science segment. Once again, if you would like to hear the entire thing, you can check out our Mixcloud page at citr.ca/news. It is now time for our health segment, brought to you by our health team, Dietetics Intuition. They're following up last week's segment on endurance with this week on strength.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Okay, hi everyone. Today we'll be talking about eating for strength athletes. So this is a continuation of our two-part segment on sports nutrition. And last week we covered eating for endurance athletes, and we'll have all this information on our blog shortly after the segment. So we want to clarify our definition of a strength athlete before we start. So these athletes rely primarily on muscle mass and physical power to compete in their chosen sport. So some common sports in this area are weightlifting, heavy throwing, events in track and field, in certain positions in football. But there are many sports that combine both strength and endurance characteristics, such as rowing, swimming, and gymnastics. So I'm sure a common question is, if you're engaging in this type of activity, then what type of diet should you follow? And according to the Olympic International Committee, the main goal for strength athletes is to enhance and maintain muscle mass to maximize performance through what you eat before, during, and after exercise. So, as you'll see later, when you eat may be more important than what you eat, but right now I'm gonna go through the main macronutrients, which is carbohydrates, protein, and fat, and give you some recommendations. So, carbohydrate is actually the key component for building muscle mass. Actually, the strategy is that you want to make sure that you're eating enough overall. And overall energy is just as important as having adequate protein in your diet, which is often a huge topic that most people are fixated on, is how much protein you're getting. But yes, carbs should be your main source of energy. And it's kind of interesting to note that less than 5% of the energy you use while exercising will come from protein. So it's primarily used to rebuild muscle after a workout or to build muscle mass. And then eating enough carbohydrates ensures that the protein in your diet is spared, meaning that your muscles will not be broken down to supplement your energy needs. So in terms of carbohydrates in your general diet, consider focusing on complex carbs, and that would be anything with fiber. So that's whole grains, beans, and other starchy vegetables. And the reason why is that it provides a steady source of energy during the day and will prevent those energy highs and lows. So simple carbohydrates are still important, but they should make up a smaller portion in your general diet, and they can definitely help for training. So following a workout, you might want to try just a fruit juice or even liquid shakes, and those have a little bit more simple carbs. So protein, which is usually a very popular topic, there is a common misconception that strength athletes need to eat a lot more protein than other athletes to support their training, but there is actually no solid evidence that having protein intakes of about, let's say, 2 grams of protein per kilogram's body weight are actually necessary or helpful for maximizing your muscle recovery. So a more reasonable suggestion would be something like 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram body weight. And just as a reference, for the average person, 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight is actually recommended. So surveys show that most athletes are already hitting this goal in their general diet without eating extra portions of protein specifically. And so protein supplements are not necessary as long as you are eating a variety of foods from all four food groups. So if you think of it this way, if you're already getting a few extra foods from different food groups, you're going to be getting an additional portion of protein, but then you'll also have other vitamins and minerals to support that extra intake and muscle recovery. So like your B vitamins and stuff like that. So exceptions to this rule, though, include athletes who avoid eating concentrated sources of protein if they are vegan or vegetarian. So like I mentioned before, when you eat might actually be more important than what you eat. So it's important to spread your protein intake across several meals and snacks during the day rather than pack it into 2 or 3 meals. And that's because our body has a certain threshold for how much protein we can process in one portion, and if you go above that, it'll just get excreted out. Or if you already have met your energy needs, it's going to turn to fat. So I'll just give you a couple examples. Like a classic and really great recovery drink is chocolate milk, one glass, because it has a good mix of carbohydrates and protein. And then even cheese and crackers, sandwiches with meat fillings like ham or cheese, and dried fruit and nut mixes is great too. So Jess is going to cover the rest on this topic.
Hello, so now I'm going to be talking to you about fat. So fat is an important source of energy for all athletes, but may play a more important role in endurance athletes over strength athletes. Your body burns carbohydrates during the first 30 minutes of exercising. So once those carbohydrate stores are exhausted, our body switches over to burning fat for energy. So strength athletes tend to compete in shorter events and therefore rely primarily on carbohydrates to fuel their workouts. However, fat intakes are still an important part of a healthy diet for everyone. It's just really important to focus on unsaturated fats such as your omegas and sources that aren't saturated mainly. A good one is canola oil, for example, if you're sauteing things in a pan, or olive oil. So another burning question on everyone's minds is about supplements, and should you be taking sports supplements, and do they even work? We'll talk about two different types of supplements athletes tend to use. For the first ones are vitamins and minerals. So the vast majority of controlled studies have not been shown to have performance-enhancing effects with supplemental doses of vitamins and minerals. In other words, popping pills isn't going to increase how much you can lift or how much you can bench press, for example. Popping pills will also not make up for a proper diet. So one-a-day pills can provide insurance, but eating a variety of foods from all food groups is necessary to make sure your vitamin mineral deficiencies don't impair performance, like Sharon mentioned earlier. So the second supplement people talk about is creatine. Some strength athletes take creatine supplements in the form of powders to increase their performance. Since creatine phosphate serves as a temporary storage site for energy, the theory is that by taking supplements such as creatine, you can increase your performance during bouts of high-intensity anaerobic exercise, so that's burst activities. Science has shown that creatine supplements do improve performance. However, not everybody benefits from creatine supplements. Only those athletes whose muscle creatine levels actually increase with supplementation see an increase in performance. This means that there is an upper limit, and athletes with a high amount of creatine phosphate in their muscles may not see an effect. So the take-home message is that overall energy intake is important for strength athletes. Protein intakes are slightly higher for strength athletes, but should be met in general if you're eating a variety of foods from all food groups, so supplements are generally not needed. focus on taking small snacks with carbohydrates and protein right after training to refuel for optimal performance. And also, if you have any other queries, the great website to go to is coach.ca, and also check out Dietitians of Canada website. There's also just so much reliable information on both those websites. And we're also going to be blogging this, as usual. And that's it for this week.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
And thank you to our health team for that really interesting piece on what you should eat when putting on strength. And we're going to take a quick break on CITR 101.9 FM, but please stay tuned for your national headlines as well as your international news.
Stylize your room this semester with Bed Bath & Beyond at UBC Bookstore starting August 10th, as well as a great selection of supplies and technology. Don't forget to pick up some tasty snacks and fresh local salads in their new convenience store. Located at the corner of East Mall and University Boulevard, UBC Bookstore, where your purchases support UBC campus.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us, and it is now time for our weekday weather forecast with the one and only Phil Chang. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Claire. Thank you, and good evening, listeners. Due to a low-pressure system moving in from the Pacific direction, this week will consist of a variety of mostly sun and cloud, but definitely some precipitation towards closer towards the weekend when the bulk of the moisture coming in arrives. Apart from just looking at models around us, we can see physical indications of the incoming system. For example, throughout the week, if you look closely, you can notice the cloud cover will be getting lower and lower, and on a barometer, you can see dropping pressures. If not, it's no worries. You can take a look at temperatures, and yeah, it's going to be much colder than usual. All right, so now your weather summary for this week. Tonight, a few clouds, low of 14. Tuesday, a mix of sun and cloud, a high of 22, UV index of 6 or higher. Tuesday night, partly cloudy, low of 14. Wednesday, also cloudy, high of 21. Thursday, a mix of sun and cloud with a 30% chance of showers, low of 13, high of 19. And Friday, cloudy with 30% chance of showers, low of 12, high of 19. That's the weather summary brought to you by Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil, the UBC Storm Club. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Phil. Sorry to hear that fall is creeping in slowly.
No.
Well, looking forward to hearing your weekend weather forecast on Friday.
All
Thanks.
Yeah, you. Bye.
Bye. And that was the incredible Phil Chang. And now it is time for your national headlines.
Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney apologized Monday for the way the image of a, quote, Asian-looking woman was removed from the initial design for the new $100 banknotes. The bank handled the issue poorly, Carney said in a statement. The statement read, quote, I apologize to those who were offended. The bank's handling of this issue did not meet the standards Canadians justifiably expect of us. Our banknotes belong to all Canadians, and the work we do at the bank is for all Canadians, end quote. The central bank came under fire last week when the Canadian press revealed that the image of an Asian-looking woman was removed from the original design after some focus groups raised questions about the image. Some in the group said the Asian woman did not represent Canada, while others said other ethnic groups should be shown as well. In the end, an image of a Caucasian-looking woman was substituted in a move a bank spokesman said was to restore a neutral ethnicity. The original design never went into circulation. A spokeswoman for the Chinese-Canadian National Council called the move racist and demanded the bank change its policies to stop erasing visible minorities from Canada's money. Carney said that while that image was shown to eight focus groups in 2009, the bank was already changing it to ensure it did not resemble an actual person, suggesting the focus group input had no bearing.
And now for our coverage of the upcoming Quebec provincial elections. Parti Québécois leader Pauline Marois used the first Quebec election debate to repeatedly attack Prime Minister Stephen Harper in a hint of federal-provincial battles that might follow the September 4 vote. The PQ has said that if it's elected, it will seek a transfer of powers from Ottawa in areas like employment insurance, immigrant and immigration policy. The party says it will use each refusal from the Tories to build its case that Quebec doesn't belong to Canada. However, critics charge the PQ leader with being too timid about talking about her plan for independence. The co-leader of Quebec Solidaire, François David, discussed her own ideas for achieving independence more explicitly than the main sovereigntist leader. She was even wearing the red square symbol of the student protest movement. This was in contrast to Marois, who has stopped wearing that square. As for the student protest, which had dominated political discussion for months, they rarely came up on Sunday.
With his political survival in doubt, Premier Jean Charest used a two-birds-with-one-stone attack. He kept reverting to themes that could harm both his main rivals simultaneously: doubts about Quebec independence and alleged ethical misdeeds of the last PQ government. Charest said neither of his rivals could be trusted on the independence issue. Some of his most pointed remarks were aimed at Legault, the former PQ minister and now leader of the new coalition party. Quebec's provincial campaign entered a new phase Sunday with the first in a string of televised leadership debates. There are four debates on four consecutive nights, giving voters a chance to better weigh their options. Sunday's was the only debate that will include all four leaders of the biggest parties, while the remaining ones will feature a series of one-on-ones. The four topics Sunday were the economy, governance, social policy, and the national question and identity. Tonight, Quebecers will get to see the second of four back-to-back election debates. Charest will square off against Marois, who is leading in the polls and is currently considered the front-runner to replace him. The province is experimenting with an unconventional debate format in the run-up to the September 4th election.
And those were your national headlines here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We now go to our international news, and to start off, we have a segment from our Australian correspondent, Alex Hamer, about asylum seekers in Australia.
The biggest news in the Asia-Pacific region in the last 2 weeks has been the Australian government's new legislation, which is designed to stop the arrival of asylum seekers by boat. So far this year, 7,500 people have arrived illegally in Australian waters. They're mostly fleeing Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. The reason the government is concerned is because a large number of refugees have drowned in the last year. At least 200 have died, with more missing. With the new plan, the arrivals will be sent to the island nation of Nauru and Manus Island, which is part of Papua New Guinea. There are detention centres already on these islands as part of an immigration program from the early 2000s. There is a lot of controversy with this new plan, as the damaging nature of long-term detention on already traumatised people has been proven. The UN Commission on Refugees says that, quote, "We do not want to see a return to lengthy delays in remote island centres for asylum seekers and refugees before durable solutions are found. We are also concerned about the psychological impact for these individuals who would be affected." One of the architects of the plan says that reopening Nauru and Manus are the smallest and most temporary parts of the report. They're short circuit breakers designed to save lives at sea while we get everything else in place. Now, at the moment, there are thousands of refugees in camps in Indonesia waiting for either recognition as refugees and visas to Australia, or waiting for a place on a boat run by a people smuggler. Now, it's these people smugglers that the Australian government is trying to stop, and they have support from the Australian people for this. In a poll run by the Age newspaper last week, 71% of people supported offshore processing as a deterrent. Another poll from a year ago asked where illegal arrivals should be processed. 40% said the Australian mainland, 35% said nowhere, they should be sent straight home, and all other respondents said offshore. So, depending on the question, there is always a lot of support for offshore processing. The detention centres on Nauru and Manus Island were shut down by the current government, although under a previous leader, and this was quite popular. But increasing arrivals, 7,500 this year, and increasing deaths have made this one of the only options open. Even the left-wing party, the Greens, has been attacked for not supporting the government's new plan because it wants to integrate asylum seekers straight into the community. The debate has changed quite substantially from whether we should allow people straight into the community to whether we should allow them into the country at all. The government's had to make a really, really tricky decision here, and there is one good part of it that is eventually going to help quite a lot of disadvantaged people in Southeast Asia. They've increased Australia's refugee intake from 13,000 a year to 20,000, effective immediately. And in the next 2 years, that's going to move to 27,000. So that's a plus for the asylum seekers. However, how many people are damaged beyond repair by detention that could go on for years and years, and the Prime Minister has said she's not sure how long that'll last, is unquantifiable at the moment. So we're going to have to wait and see. But that's it from me, and see you in the next fortnight.
Thank you to Alex for that report. Once again, that was our correspondent Alex Hamer reporting from Melbourne, Australia for News 101. So now for more international news, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm George Lavender with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Syrian government forces continued to attack cities across the country today. Opposition groups reported heavy shelling in the cities of Aleppo and Daraa, as well as the capital, Damascus. Videos posted online, purportedly from the southern city of Daraa, show the ruins of several recently destroyed buildings. 120 people were killed on Monday, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The latest killings come on the same day that UN observers depart the country at the end of a four-month monitoring mission. On Sunday, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad appeared in public for the first time since a bomb attack in the capital, Damascus, last month killed several senior members of his government. Assad was shown praying in a mosque in the capital to mark the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Protests against the regime took place at other mosques around the country. In Bahrain, hundreds of mourners attended a funeral over the weekend for a teenager killed by police during a demonstration in the country's capital, Manama. 16-year-old Hussam al-Haddad was killed on Friday in what opposition activists called a brutal attack. Activists say al-Haddad was shot by security forces and then beaten and kicked. The Bahraini government says he was part of a group throwing petrol bombs. Opposition groups say 45 people have died in protests in Bahrain since June 2011. Reproductive rights advocates are applauding a decision by Kansas prosecutors to drop all remaining criminal charges against a Planned Parenthood clinic. The clinic was accused by the former Kansas Attorney General of performing abortions that were illegal under the state's law. FSRN's Danny Wood reports from Kansas City.
Kansas Attorney General Derek Smith and Johnson County District Attorney Steve Howe announced the dismissal of the final 32 misdemeanor counts against Planned Parenthood of Kansas and Mid-Missouri. The original case, brought by former Kansas Attorney General Phil Klein in 2007, accused the clinic of 107 charges, including falsifying records and performing illegal late-term abortions. The case centered on whether the clinic was determining the age and viability of fetuses that were aborted according to state law. In their joint statement, prosecutors Smith and Howe said the clinic was complying with the law. Today, Peter Brownlee, president of Kansas and Mid-Missouri Planned Parenthood, said the dismissal of the charges was a significant victory and called the original case baseless and politically motivated.
We really believe this case and its outcome should serve as a warning to all Kansans, and in fact all Americans, about the dangers in our free society of electing extremists to positions of power.
Former Attorney General Klein accused the current Attorney General of improperly defining viability and of not understanding the charges. Danny Wood, FSRN, Kansas City.
Condemnation of a Republican candidate for Senate is growing following comments he made about rape and abortion. Congressmember Todd Akin told a Missouri news station that a woman was unlikely to become pregnant if she was the victim of, quote, legitimate rape. Akin was defending his view that abortion should be illegal even in the case of rape. Some have called for Akin to be removed from his position on the House Science and Technology Committee, and fellow Republican Scott Brown said he should drop out of the Senate race. In Montana, about 200 people have taken part in a week-long convergence against coal exports. The convergence at the state capital was called after Arch Coal, the country's second-largest coal company, applied to open a new mine in the state. Lowell Chanda is an organizer with the Blue Skies campaign. He says the proposed Otter Creek mine will open up the way for more mining in the region, producing coal to be sent to new export terminals on the West Coast.
There's a lot of issues with the rail line. Because if these proposals go through, there could be up to 60 coal trains moving per day throughout the Northwest region from the Powder River Basin to the West Coast. And then also dumping this large amount, up to 170 million tons a year if the proposals go through, onto the international energy market could have huge implications for climate change. So there's a lot of environmental issues and economic issues.
Organizers say 23 people were arrested for nonviolent direct actions during the course of the convergence. In South Dakota, indigenous people are attempting to prevent the sale of land in the Black Hills that is held sacred by the Lakota people. The land is set to be auctioned off to the highest bidder later this week. For FSRN, Jim Kent reports.
Nearly 2,000 acres of land in South Dakota is set to go on the auction block later this week. Paysla, which means the heart of all that is considered one of the most sacred sites for Lakota people. Much of the Paysla site has been owned by the Reynolds, a non-native family, for several generations. But they've now decided to sell the land. Many indigenous people are concerned that the land will be developed. Gay Kingman is part of the grassroots effort that's trying to protect the sacred site from development.
We hope the family will meet with us. We know that the family has taken good care of the land, and they've allowed us to go on there and do our sacred ceremonies.
Several tribes and other groups are attempting to raise the funds to buy the land with individual donations. The Reynolds family plans to sell their property to the highest bidder this Saturday. Jim Kent, Free Speech Radio News in the Black Hills, South Dakota.
And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Oakland, California, I'm George Lavender.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines. For more in-depth coverage, we go back to them. Our first segment is on the West Bank and Palestinian conflict.
Miners in South Africa have largely defied a deadline issued by their employer to return to work today. More than 70% of the workers at the Marikana Platinum Mine stayed off the job, and officials with the mining company Lonmin said that the mine was unable to restart full production. The stalemate continues after a controversial week in which police opened fire on a group of workers, killing 34. FSRN's Davison Mutsingwa reports.
The South African government is battling to retain stability following a week of clashes that left dozens of miners and two police officers dead at the platinum mine situated outside Rustenburg, about 60 miles northwest of Johannesburg. President Jacob Zuma announced a raft of measures in a bid to contain the labor issue that escalated into a tragedy.
Today is not an occasion for blame, finger-pointing, or recrimination.
The president has appointed a commission of inquiry to investigate the root cause of the violence. A week of mourning has also been declared, and a high-level delegation of ministers has visited the mine in an effort to ease tensions. But rights organizations and ordinary South Africans described the moves as too little, too late.
What the police did was trying to keep the people quiet by shooting them, and that's not the proper way to do things.
27-year-old Themba Vilakazi's sentiments are shared by many South Africans who say the Marikana situation should have been handled better.
Sending a shooting squad to go and massacre people is not a solution, because the problems are still there. They need to be sorted out.
For Social Commentator Francis Wesham, the fatal clashes on Thursday were a culmination of long unresolved issues of mine workers. He told FSRN that the Marikana situation represents the general plight of mine workers in South Africa.
If you look at the post-apartheid era in South Africa, this is the worst thing that has ever happened. And I believe that there's a lack of leadership in government. There's lack of... They need to address the root cause of the problems that miners themselves are facing, because the miners are being ill-treated. They have genuine grievances.
Addressing the striking miners this weekend, former ruling party youth leader Julius Malema urged the president and police minister to resign. The workers commenced the World Cat protest last week, forcing the closure of Lonmin's South African operations. Miners only make about $500 a month for working more than 8 hours a day in often dangerous conditions. Deaths at platinum mines have also increased this year. South Africa produces more than 80% of the world's platinum, but operations have been affected by high costs of energy and water. Tefson Zingwa, FSRN, South Africa.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. You can also check out our current segments and interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. We will continue our international coverage with Free Speech Radio News.
Family remain in the hospital, some in critical condition, after what is widely suspected as being an Israeli settler attack near their West Bank home. Despite widespread condemnation from Israeli politicians, human rights groups say few have been brought to justice as settler attacks against Palestinians increase. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore has the story from Jerusalem.
At Jerusalem's Hadassah Hospital, 5-year-old Mohammed Jayada lies almost motionless on a bed, barely able to keep his eyes open. His torso, knees, and both arms are bandaged. His face, paling and shiny, is discolored pink and black. His grandmother cries softly at his bedside. One day earlier, Mohammed and five of his family members were driving in a Palestinian-plated taxi near their village of Nahalin in the occupied West Bank when a Molotov cocktail was thrown at their car. All six family members were treated for severe burns. two family members, including Mohammed's father, remain in critical condition at the hospital. Israeli settlers from the nearby Gush Etzion settlement block are suspected for the attack. Adnan Azazmeh is a relative of the family and fellow resident of Nahalin. He told FSRN that the entire village is devastated about what happened.
This has affected very negatively all the situation in the area. The village feeling like heat. Everybody angry, very angry about that because this is very serious issue and this is related to children. They are innocents. They have nothing to do with politics, with anything. They are just children and they are a family.
Attacks against Palestinians have been on the rise. Israeli settlers killed 3 Palestinians and injured 183 last year, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. That marked a 32% jump from 2010 and a 144% increase from 2009. In the U.S. State Department's annual report on terrorism, released last week, officials labeled violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank as terrorism for the first time. The U.S. has also condemned Friday's firebomb attack. On Sunday, Israeli Vice Prime Minister Moshe Yaalon defined the taxicab firebombing as a terrorist attack and said that it ran contrary to Jewish morality and values. The Israeli police have also vowed to bring the individuals responsible to justice. Israeli police spokesperson Mickey Rosenfeld told FSRN that a special task force has been set up to investigate who is behind the attack.
Obviously, we'll do everything we can in order to find the suspects who are behind that incident. But it's not clear at the moment exactly why that Palestinian vehicle, that Palestinian taxi, was targeted. And that's what the Israeli police at the moment are concentrating on.
Citing Israel's population registry, The Guardian reports that the Israeli settler population of the West Bank has nearly doubled over the last decade to more than 350,000 people. The UK-based paper also reports that the Israeli government's spending on West Bank settlements increased by nearly 40% under current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Human rights groups say the Israeli authorities' failure so far to hold settlers accountable for crimes committed against Palestinians has emboldened settlers and led to a situation of impunity. Leo Yavne is research director at Israeli human rights group Yesh Din.
Settler violence has been a wide phenomenon here for many years now, and certainly this latest incident marks a new low. Part of the problem can be attributed to the fact that Israeli police investigations into these incidents usually fail. Yesh Din is monitoring hundreds of settler incidents and the way they are investigated, and we find that over 90% of these investigations fail to reach indictments. It contributes to a large sense to the fact that these incidents are ongoing.
In its 2011 report on settler violence, the UN documented Israeli settler attacks on 10,000 Palestinian-owned trees, which were either damaged or destroyed. About 140 Palestinians were also displaced due to settler violence. The UN found that nearly 250,000 Palestinians in 80 communities are at risk of settler violence in the West Bank. Jillian Kessler-Damour, FSRN, Jerusalem.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for that in-depth coverage of global headlines. Their daily headlines and their full newscast can be found on their website, freespeechradionews.org. FSRN.org. And now we go to Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman interviews Michael Ratner, who is the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a legal advisor to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
To turn directly back to Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, legal advisor to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The news conference, as it continues, the Foreign Affairs Minister of Ecuador has announced that Julian Assange has been granted asylum by Ecuador. Michael Ratner, if you can talk about the significance of this. Again, Julian Assange now in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He has been granted asylum by the country of Ecuador. What does this mean?
Well, Amy, personally, first of all, I'm really thrilled and moved. I mean, Julian Assange has been under such incredible pressure with the threats to go in and get him, with prosecutions by the U.S., et cetera, that this is an incredibly courageous move by Ecuador. I mean, you have to think about it. Julian Assange, in doing what he and WikiLeaks did, stood up to the great powers of the world. And now you see Ecuador, again, standing up to the great powers. And so it's an amazing act, really, and we should just applaud and support Ecuador for doing what was legally required here, which is to give Julian Assange asylum for his role as a journalist and a publisher of WikiLeaks. What does it mean? Well, what it means is, first of all, is the British ought to just back off and the U.S. ought to just back off. He has a legal right to asylum under the Refugee Convention, under the UN declarations. There cannot be any adverse consequences for a country's granting asylum. It's considered a humanitarian act. And for the British to say that they're going to go into the embassy and get out someone who's been granted asylum would turn the Refugee Convention and asylum completely on its head. It's unheard of. As far as I know, it's never been done before that you've gone into an embassy to pull out someone granted asylum. The British are only doing this as bullies, bullies most likely for the United States. What it also means to me is once he's been given asylum, which is this great moment, really, I mean, it's just a long road still to get Julian Assange his freedom and to get the right to publish again without adverse consequences. But it's a great moment. He also, in my view, has a right to leave that embassy, get on a plane and go to Ecuador. Will the British ever honor that with the kinds of threats they're making against Julian Assange? I doubt it right now. But that's the law to me. You're given asylum. The British can't pick him up and then send him to a country where he will then be persecuted. And that's what the road is. He'll be going to Sweden if they pick him up and then to the United States. And it's as if you're sending someone back into the hands of those who are persecuting them. They can't do it, and they should not only back off the embassy, they should ensure that he is allowed free passage out of the United Kingdom.
Michael Ratner, if someone who's granted political asylum, as Julian Assange now has, if he got into a car to go to the airport, what is that territory considered, the actual car?
You know, I think that's an open question at this point. I think it should still be considered under the diplomatic protection of the Ecuadorian embassy. I think there's enough law to say that. But the additional point here is the one I'm making is once you've been given asylum, it's not like you can be then picked up by a country and sent into the hands of your persecutor, whether it's in the car, whether it's on the streets, wherever you are, it's illegal to do so. And it's illegal for the British to go into that embassy. It's illegal for them to stop Julian Assange trying to get to Ecuador. Whether a bully of a country like the UK with the US behind it will listen and understand and adhere to what the law is at this point is not clear, considering the saber rattling and what I would call the gunboat diplomacy, if you want to even call it diplomacy, but the gunboats that the British are essentially using against Julian Assange in Ecuador.
You know, we were just talking about death squads in El Salvador. Actually, in 1980, when the Archbishop of El Salvador was killed in El Salvador, Oscar Romero, just a few months before January 31st, 1980, in Guatemala, Rigoberto Menchú, the Nobel Peace Prize winner's father, Vicente Menchú, had taken refuge in the Spanish embassy in Guatemala City, and he and many others were killed as the Guatemalan forces burned the Spanish embassy to the ground. Michael Ratner.
You know, Amy, I'm familiar with that as you are, and it's an incredible what it says is the kinds of governments that do what the British are doing are basically inhuman and have bloodstains on them for generations. For doing this. Bloodstains for generations. So if the British are acting like that, then they're essentially acting as the equivalent of what the Guatemalans did to Rigoberto Menchú's father. Mm.
So right now, this is actual political asylum. He stays in the London embassy. What about Sweden's demands that he be extradited? And what does this mean for him now? He's been there for several months, Michael Ratner.
Well, first of all, it's an incredible plus for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and for the work they're doing. It shows that under political asylum, that being a truth teller, being a publisher of truth, is something that is protected by fundamental international law and particularly the Refugee Convention. So on its first level, it just really gives an imprimatur of of positiveness to what WikiLeaks has done over the last couple of years. Very important. The second thing it does is it really makes Julian Assange into an internationally protected person, telling the world, leave your hands off him. You can't take him into Sweden and then push him into the United States, where the Ecuadorian government has essentially found, and found really dramatically found, that he will not receive a fair trial in the United States. That he will be treated like Manning has been treated. He will be treated really like the Guantanamo detainees have been treated. He will be treated under a system that to the extent that ever offered a fair trial, certainly doesn't offer it anymore. That's an incredible indictment of the United States. But Ecuador is saying Julian Assange is now a protected person under international law. You cannot come into our embassy and get him. And in fact, he has the right to leave that embassy and go to Ecuador. Let's just see how this plays out, because, of course, Ecuador is a small country. It has just stood up, and we should understand that it has just stood up to the most powerful countries in the world, the UK and the United States. Let's hope that the rule of law, that the understanding of what the asylum convention meant in 1951, what asylum means today, will be adhered to by the British.
Michael Ratner, the significance of Baltasar Garzon becoming one of the attorneys for Julian Assange, the well-known Spanish judge and prosecutor who was consulting with the Ecuadorian government in Quito, what about his presence as part of your team?
Well, a part of our team would be an understatement, Amy. Baltasar Garzon really is the head of the team, and the one that is really has the ability and the political ability to move in Latin America and around the world to be able to negotiate and think politically what the next steps are for Julian Assange. But what's really interesting about Baltasar Garzon's case is how similar what happened to him are related to what's happened to Julian Assange. Baltasar Garzon lost his job as a judge in Spain because he wanted to be a truth teller, open up the 140,000 disappeared in the Spanish Civil War in the 30s. And the conservatives, the Falange, the right wing in Spain didn't want him to do that. And they then came up with excuses to get him tried and get him knocked off the bench. He's a truth teller in the same way that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are truth tellers. So in certain way, Julian Assange and Baltasar Garzon are joined at the hip. Baltasar Garzon and my work with him on this case, he has been extraordinary, incredibly supportive, doing everything he can to ensure that Julian Assange will get asylum and that he will be protected. And he understands the diplomacy of it.
Well, Michael Ratner, I want to thank you very much for being with us, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, legal advisor to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. I know you're getting calls from around the world. Again, the announcement, Ecuador has granted political asylum to Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder. He's in the embassy right now in London, where he can stay. Ecuador has agreed he can stay, but the British government, the authorities through the night, the question was, would they raid the embassy? And that continues to be a question. Of course, we'll continue to cover this situation. Final words, Michael, as we leave you to deal with the world's media trying to find out the latest analysis on what's taking place.
Well, it's an incredibly moving and important day for Julian Assange. I mean, we have been sitting here waiting and waiting and hoping for this moment for Julian, for WikiLeaks, for a free press. And so it's incredibly important. And now for all of us is supporting Ecuador's decision to give Julian Assange asylum and to push back the British and the U.S. who want to try and extract him and put him on trial as a scapegoat for their own crimes. Incredibly important day and moving day for Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and Free Press.
Michael Ratner, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we go back to Phoenix because there is a...
And thank you to Amy Goodman for that interview with Michael Ratner, who is the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the legal advisor to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And
that's our program for today, which is Monday, August 20th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments or get involved or give us an important news tip,
contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by myself. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Soul Throats Clapping Hands with your host Robert right here on CITR 101.9 FM.